Welcome! This is the podcast of Care Austria with Andrea Barstorff-Hager.
Welcome to the Care in Action podcast, and I'm really honored now to introduce our guest of today, which is Mohamed Sleiman Labat. And I'm reluctant to introduce his ethnic group, but you mention it everywhere. You are a Sahrawi who advocates for education and human rights. You fled from conflict in Western Sahara, and you became, in the meantime, a quite powerful voice for refugees in general and for human rights. And you are a winner of this year Stats Prize Africa. It was introduced by the European Commission this year, the first time, with a special focus on Africa. And you are one of the winners with a magical film, which is called Phosphate Desert. And it really, you have to watch it. It really starts in the middle of a desert storm, and you feel really, you feel it, even from watching it only. And this film is part of a whole installation which is called Sand Gardens. And before we dive a little bit more into your artistic work, tell me a little bit, because you have visited Vienna as a boy, and how did it come?
Well, it happened that there is an exchange program of to organize Sahrawi kids from the refugee camps to be hosted by families in different parts of Europe, partly because it gets really, really hot in the summer, so it's a way to get the kids to escape the heat, but partly also to connect families on both sides.
What was really hot in the summer when you were a kid in the Sahrawi camp?
Well, it was pretty hot.
40 degrees, something?
Oh, it's over 40.
Over 40
is okay for us.
It's, yeah, because 37, 36 we had even last week in Vienna. And this is 25 years later.
Yeah.
So I think the summers were much cooler when you visited Vienna.
Yes.
To relax from heat that they are nowadays.
I have to say that I'm really surprised about the weather I encountered here in Vienna.
Yeah.
It's a bit warm.
Mm-hmm.
I came with my jacket and my pullover. And, back at home in the desert, it's really hot. Last I was a couple of weeks ago in the desert, and it was close to 51, 52 degrees Celsius.
Enormous. That's like melting, isn't it?
It's very, very hot.
Yeah.
So you can't go outside, you can't do anything.
Yeah.
But yeah, I came to Vienna as a child through this program, and I don't really remember much of what happened.
But did you like it?
I liked it because, because I was swimming somewhere, and the one thing I really remember, it was so green.
Yeah, yeah.
Unbelievably green. Like, it was a shock to me to come from the desert and see all of these trees and plants and everywhere.
But as a boy of 8-9 years, didn't you feel homesick?
Well, I must have felt something, but we're used to traveling a lot, even as kids.
Okay.
So, actually, from the refugee camps, we go to study abroad and to go to these programs very often, actually. I left home when I was 12 to study, and I was away for most of the year, every year. and through this program, I went 3 times to Europe. I went here, I came to Vienna, I came the next year, went to Rome with another family, and then twice to Spain with another Spanish family. I have 4 families in Europe.
So you were a global citizen sitting in a refugee camp in Western Algeria?
Yes.
In the Hamada Desert?
Yes. So as much as it sounds like it's a very isolated place, it's a very connected place to Europe as well.
And may I ask you bluntly, didn't you have a sort of cultural shock? Because as an organization, I'm the CEO of Care in Austria, we are super reluctant, we never ever do it as a matter of fact, to bring young children to Europe from any place in the world.
Well, the way it was organized in the camps is that it comes through The main reason, as I said, it's really a way to so that the kids can escape the unbearable heat.
Yeah.
It's really like difficult.
Okay.
But also, it was sometimes it's kind of a prize for the kids who are good in school.
Mm-hmm.
So I remember going twice because I was the first in my class, and they said, "Oh, you can also join their program just because you got a good grades." You know,
so it, kind of, it was like a prize, winning a prize. So you are used to winning awards.
I got prizes.
I know that you won a lot of prizes. But I was really wondering when I prepared for that, because I in my job function I have visited lots of refugee camps, and I never met a person first who was sent to Vienna to bear the heat, because there are many hot places in the whole Sahel, as you know,
yeah,
better than I do. And
yeah,
the hottest day I experienced was in Mali, in the desert. It was 48 or something. You really had the idea that your head is exploding.
Okay.
Yeah, you couldn't do literally nothing. And I was really wondering, and one of my colleagues, she asked me, how did he start to create a studio in a refugee camp?
Yeah.
How did you do that? But now that you are telling me that you have four European families and that you are a highly trained prize winner since you have been a boy, then maybe this was also adding to your inspiration, was it?
Well, in 2015, there was a huge flood,
mm-hmm,
in the Sahara refugee camps,
mm-hmm,
and it took us by surprise because this is the desert. It
mm-hmm
really hardly rains.
Mm-hmm. Like, but if it might come as a big wave?
Yes, I mean, so usually like it rains for a few minutes,
mm-hmm,
once a year around
mm-hmm
September, but this kind of big torrential
mm-hmm
floods or rains,
mm-hmm,
they come around every 9 or 10 years,
mm-hmm,
so it's a kind of a, it looks like some sort of a decade phenomena.
Mm-hmm.
And so in 2015, it flooded. And it took us by surprise because people forget between 10 years, you know?
Yeah, yeah.
But because we're living in tents and mud houses, so the water just started to erode the bottoms of the buildings, and they collapsed within 15 minutes.
Everything was destroyed.
Everything.
Mm-hmm.
So it collapsed.
And many people died.
No, I don't remember that anybody died,
because okay,
actually when it starts to rain, people avoid the mud houses because we know it's vulnerable in front of the water.
Mm-hmm.
So we will be in tents or even outside, like on top of a hill or something. People would, you know, take
They are
operation.
Resilient to
yes
the harsh living condition.
Yes.
Yeah.
And so we lost our home, like many other families in the camp. I was especially devastated because I'm an artist, and I lost my artworks, my books, my laptop, everything was collapsed. It was under the
Did
room.
Did you have your studio already in
2015?
No,
I actually was working from the same room that my
mm-hmm
family had. So it was our guest room, our living room, the place where we slept in, the place where we had our food, and the place where I practiced my art. And it was also my library because my books are there. So it was everything that we had, and it collapsed, and yeah, everything was gone in 15 minutes.
You had to start from scratch.
Yes.
To rebuild everything.
So a few days after, I was going around when the mud has when it was started to get a dry bit, I was going around in the camp and seeing huge damage around the community and people lost.
You know, how many things. People lived in that camp at that time?
Well, Samara, where I'm based, is one of the biggest camps
mm-hmm
actually in that area, and it could be close to 60,000
yeah
people.
And is it a UN camp?
It's a Sahrawi camp. The UN is not monitoring or administering.
So you are self-organizing.
It is a
which is also remarkable.
Yes.
Which is nothing.
Yes.
That happens many times.
Yes. No, the Sahrawi refugee camps are
mm-hmm
one of the most self-organized camps.
Okay.
The UN does have a role.
Yeah.
They organize providing international food to arrive
mm-hmm
from abroad to the camp. But it's Sahrawi women who take care of organizing, distributing, and making sure that everyone gets their share.
And no other international NGOs
no
interfering.
No.
That's
absolutely
really
not
remarkable.
Yeah.
Because I I personally, of course, I don't know every single camp in the world, but I have really visited many, especially in the Sahel, also in Bangladesh, the Rohingya. CARE is working in all of them, and it's not only CARE, it's the big NGOs that collaborate with the United Nations and sometimes also the state that the camp is situated in. So it's really interesting. And this is a self-administrated Sahrawi camp. And you sound like this is a place where you can live.
Except that we accept that it's not up to the Sahrawi are not being asked, where do you want to live? So the Sahrawi found themselves in this challenging situation, because the Sahrawi arrived in this refugee camp not out of their will. They were driven out of their homeland in Western Sahara.
Let's talk a little bit about the history without getting too deep into politics, because we are independent as CARE. But it's all started in times of colonialization with the Spanish, right? And this ethnic group was deprived of everything, of land, and the land was full of resources. And this is why it is so precious. Today, 80%, is it correct, of the Saharani area is controlled by the state of Morocco.
Yes, that's true.
Which is not willing to give in. And the UN has been trying for decades to find a livable solution. And of course, talking about the Sahrawi, we can't leave out that there is also a military arm, Polisario, right? Who is not fighting to find a livable solution, but who wants independence and also wants the control of the mineral resources in the region, to make it, to frame it very broadly. No solution is found so far. I myself have experienced that many countries are not acknowledging the situation as it is. But it is an open case, and it will stay there for much longer. And this is the reason why you and your people are forced to live in this self-organized refugee camp in Western Algeria, right? Add what you want to add.
We know now that it's very complicated political situation. Legally, it's clear that it's a non-self-governing territory, according to the UN, and that in cases of non-self-governing territory, it's the local people who should be asked, should be a referendum organized to so that the local population decide where they want to be. So regardless of Morocco or the Polisario or Algeria, it's the Sahrawi people who should decide.
Nobody should decide for us. The civil society itself.
Yes.
The society. How many are...
Well, it's in the refugee camps now, it's close to 200,000 people.
Okay, so it's quite a large group.
Yes. But it's not happening, and so the Sahrawi are in these refugee camps, and the situation is at stagnation. Nothing is happening, you know? While the political situation at stagnation, the community is not giving up, trying to all sorts of things to live a dignified life, to continue to survive as a culture as well, because we don't want to be disconnected from our identity and our homeland and who we are, where we come from. And so the camps, for example, are named after cities and geographic references in Western Sahara. As much as we have Laayoune and Dakhla and Smara and Boujdour in Western Sahara, the camps in Algeria are also named Boujdour, Samara, Dakhla, Laayoune, Boujdour. There's a very strong cultural scene of maintaining the Sahrawi culture and identity and the language and the history alive, because even if we cannot have our land, but we cannot give up on who we are.
I mean, this is more than cultural heritage thing. This is a claim for your territory.
Yes.
Directly connected to
yes.
it. So I didn't want to get too political, but of course you can't leave it out, because this is much more than defining an art piece to link the past with the future. There's a direct link to the claim of territory and use of the resources.
Absolutely, absolutely. Because
and the living conditions are super harsh, as I saw in your film.
Yeah.
It's not.
Yeah.
It sounds. You present it in a very elegant way, if I may say. But looking at the film, I only can highly recommend it, because then you get a deep impression. Okay, there is a colorful culture, and obviously you have a super artistic eye for filming to capture really the desert, just the dryness, the heat. I really could feel all that when I watched the film and I saw the people talking about their faith and their harsh life. Yeah? But on the other side, it is really difficult not to lose hope, faith, and energy in such a situation. Because I was wondering, watching your film and reading more and more about you, are there more such strong advocates for the Saharani issue than you?
Oh yeah, absolutely. There are many artists and singers and poets and people acting in other aspects.
So would you say that art is opening and connecting you to the outer world?
Yes, artists play such an important role, bringing the story to the outside world, but also bringing hope and activating creativity.
For yourself and your
ourself.
Own community.
Yes.
So it's in two directions.
Yes. Yes. As much as it is important for me to bring my film or my art to different exhibitions around Europe, for example, I would like to go back and continue what I'm doing, because that's very important. It's about creating food locally.
Mm-hmm.
It's about solving problems. It's about creating dignified life.
And especially fresh food, right?
Yes.
Because this is something that this camp might have in common with other refugee and emergency camps, that fresh food is scarce.
Yeah.
You hardly find fresh food in desert areas.
Yeah.
And
I mean,
it's expensive to bring it there. And you found an interesting way to produce it using traditional knowledge and merging it with technology and knowledge of today, right? These are the famous sand gardens.
Yeah. So you have to understand that the gardens that are emerging in the Sahrawi community are really new phenomena. That we like maybe a few years ago. So there's a bit of a surprising element even for us as Sahrawi, because we come from a nomadic community.
Mm-hmm.
Our parents and grandparents were not farmers.
Mm-hmm.
They did not.
They lived on milk and meat.
Yes, they raised camels and camel herds and goats.
And the bigger the herd, the more wealth.
They followed their herds across the desert.
Yep.
You know, to farm means a new, completely new relationship. It's about plants, it's not about animals.
And being settled.
Yes.
And the wealth, you can't see it that good in plants.
What's that?
The wealth of a family, you can't see it in field and crop. You see it in cattle. Because I've worked a long time in Ethiopia.
I don't think it's really about wealth here. It's really
because the bigger the herd.
Yes, that's in the past, but I didn't get to witness that, because I was born in this camp.
Okay.
I didn't get to see it.
So these are the stories of the ancient times.
Yes.
Yeah.
The shock is, for example, for somebody like my father.
Yeah.
Who lived much of his life as a nomad, and now he's experiencing all of these societal changes in the community.
Which is the biggest change culturally?
Yes.
From nomadic life to farmer's life.
Yes.
Yeah.
So to engage with farming, with the plants and all of these is a new kind of knowledge that is completely different from working with
animals
and things. So that's a bit of a shock or a surprise to the community. But also it took some time for the...
To convince
the people that...
What did they do before you started the sand gardens?
People are dependent on international aid, food aid.
Okay.
So the food aid
is also out of this sort of forced lethargy. You thought we have to start something new as a community. Because if you wait for international food aid, I've witnessed it so many times, this is nothing you want to be doing as a human being.
Yeah.
So it makes you tired, it makes you passive,
yeah.
and you need a string to work on and be a bit creative to have a sense in life. It's not enough to get food. Food by far is not enough. It's important, but it doesn't create a full society.
Yes.
Yeah.
Well, first of all, I have to be careful with the pronouns here because you, not just me. So it's a collective effort.
Yeah.
There are many other people involved.
Yeah.
There are the agriculture engineers,
mm-hmm.
The community members, collectives, the women.
All parts of society.
There are many people involved in this process. So we should, by no means, we should attribute it to me. I'm an artist and storyteller and part of the movement. And
but it needs someone who sparks it?
Yes.
And you are the
No, I didn't spark it. I'm only part of it.
Okay.
Yes. So, but it developed like slowly because I really don't want to take credit for something I did not spark like on my own.
Okay.
I'm not the only person doing this. I have a role in it. I'm contributing as much as many other people contributing to it. So there's a scientific input from the agriculture engineers, for example, but there is input from the community, from the families who are taking this knowledge and making it accessible, doable, possible by the means they have. So
it was a pure co-creation of different stakeholders.
Yes.
That's how we put it today. Now.
Yes.
Now that's how we frame it.
Yes. So, for example, there's a Sahrawi agriculture, an amazing Sahrawi agriculture engineer called Tal Ibrahim, who could possibly be one of the first graduates of agriculture or agronomy. And when he came to the camps, he's a Sahrawi himself, and when he, because this is the case for many Sahrawi young people when they go abroad and then they study and then they go back to the camps to try to find solutions. And so he studied and then he came back to the camps and wanted to establish gardens. But again, he faced this challenge of the Sahrawi having a nomadic background and not having, like, it's not easy for them to switch, right? But then also the reality of the conditions are really not supporting him because it's a desert, so no water, not enough water, too much sunlight, crazy sandstorms, and a refugee camp dependent on food, water distribution. So how can you make a garden?
Yeah,
you know,
that's really an issue.
So, but surprisingly, based exactly on those challenges, the knowledge started to develop of how to make this kind of farming, which is very special. We're not saying that this kind of farming would be applicable anywhere else in the world, you know, but we started from where we are and what conditions do we have, what context are we in, and then build up on that knowledge. So, okay, we look at one thing, we don't have enough water, then we build the sandoponic gardens. The sandoponic gardens is a way to utilize sand as a growing medium for plants. And it holds water for a very long time. So you don't have to water it every day. Because the first attempts to grow plants in the desert, the sandy desert, would just suck the water immediately. And there's no
it
water.
It evaporates.
Yes.
Yeah.
But when you hold it in this kind of basic system where it's contained in a container, and it is a bit of a drainage, so it's dripping outside in a bucket or something. Then you collect the water and put it back.
And put it back.
It's
then it's a cycle.
Yes, and so we don't lose the water. But also we realize that the system maintains water for a very long time. We actually tested for how long.
And water is super scarce.
What's
because
that?
Because water, you don't have water available.
No,
because
we don't have water. No,
when it comes in trucks, that's super expensive. And you really have
to be... It's not expensive. Well, it's expensive to transport into for the UN, but people are not paying for it because it's distributed for free.
Yeah, but in general, somebody has to bring it, has to organize it, has to pay for it.
Yes,
so it is expensive.
It is expensive, but also it's limited.
And it's super limited.
Even if you
limited,
get it for free,
it's...
The limit, the amount you get is limited. So, yes, you're not going to go thirsty. You get water, but it's not enough to have a garden.
Yeah,
you know,
because a garden has to be watered.
Yes,
generously.
But this knowledge that is developed to save the water is doing an incredible, you know, way of how to preserve water. Because we've tested for how long this system can maintain the water. And we want for 3, 4, 5 days, up to 7 days without watering it.
In the desert. We have to highlight again, this is all taking place in the desert.
I've actually tested the limits of this system to go to an extreme period of 10 days without watering it. And it worked. So can you imagine watering your garden only three times a month?
No.
That's incredible.
Also here, it would not be imaginable. And with the impact of climate change, we also have limitations of water.
Yeah.
And if you have a garden, you are not allowed in August and July, in the hottest months of our year, you are not always allowed to water it, which is really...
Well, we have to highlight that this is not really any idea of ornamented garden or something for aesthetic.
No, it's something
really important for the food. It's for the food.
Yeah.
It's to produce
for fresh food.
Basic set of vegetables so the families could have access to nutritional food.
Which is really key for a refugee.
So they're not growing anything fancy. It's like a tomato, kale, lettuce.
Green leaf
Yes,
vegetable.
Green leaf vegetables.
Which needs a lot of water, to be honest.
Yes, but with this system, we're cutting on water drastically.
What really flashed me a little bit when you said that many of your people go abroad, study, go back and find solutions for their own community. So how comes the people really go back and fight for a better life for their own community instead of thinking, okay, I have a super education now, I'm traveling the world and I want a good life myself. What motivates you? What is the motor, the rationale behind?
Well, to be honest, it's this sense of community bound that we grew up living in. Growing up in this community, I saw the support that I got, not just from my family, but from our neighbors, the people who give their time, their energy, their resources, so that I can go to school, so that I can study. I don't remember going hungry because everyone was sharing whatever they have.
So it's a joint effort.
It's a joint effort.
Your life was based on a joint effort of the community.
Yes. So we feel this kind of, some sort of responsibility that we need to give back to our community. We've been raised and educated and given possibilities so that we become who we are now. I can't just forget about my people. I want to go back and give to the people who gave me. The people who educated me are probably now old people, but they were young when I was a student.
And now they can rely on you.
And now I can try, at least in my best way, to give something in return. And so it's really like nobody's pushing me, nobody's forcing me to do this. It's my will and my pleasure to go back to my community and create something and be part of any change that I think is meaningful and important locally.
And we do wish you all the best for your future projects.
Thank you.
For your art studio, and we hope to see much more of this fascinating artist from the Sahrawi camp in Western Algeria. Thank you, Mohamed Sleiman Lawat, for being my guest at the Care in Action podcast. It was a true honor.
Thank you so much for having me.
Thanks for listening. This was Care in Action, the podcast of Care Austria with Andrea Barstorff-Hager. For further information, go to care.at. Sponsored by CC Real.